mentioned here, then I would actually mention that.
Thank you. Now, for some clarity and contextualization, for a very difficult topic, I must say, until the 19th century, science was called natural philosophy and recognized as a branch of philosophy. The word scientist or even science came very late in our history by Weevil in 1834. A scientist is a person who practices science. Now, one thing that I've learned through my reading, and I think we should actually clear this right now, is that there is no single unified Judaism. And I've got the Ephron 25, so she comes from this book, but you'll get the references tomorrow. There is no single unified Islam. For somebody who was born in the Muslim faith and grew up in Muslim community, in a Muslim community, I could tell you from experience that there is no unified Islam. There's no unified Christianity, according to Schulz, or Hinduism, that has been the same in different times. You could consider this some kind of evolution, but ideas change and things change over generations. There are multiple strands of thought in each domain, influenced by cultural and historical circumstances, as well as context. So Christianity and the Christian Church, as far as my reading tells me, was never monolithic and experienced divisions and changing relationships with the scientific endeavor. So there's been no uniform view over the centuries, making this topic all the harder to grapple with. And there's no uniform view today between science and religion. And it's the same. It's the same in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Now, Karen Armstrong, who's one of my favorite historians, says even the idea of God has evolved. Now, I want to place this whole series of talks in a context, and that context is or deals with the conflict thesis. There is a thesis which says that science and religion will always be in conflict. Now, the topic of these lectures are science and religion, but in many instances we hear of science versus religion, which implies that conflict. Now, in 1896, John William Draper and Andrew Christian White wrote a history of the warfare of science with theology in Christendom. And their thesis was that science and Christianity were always in conflict. Now, if we think of that today and listen to Dawkins, Harris, Sam Harris, Dennett and Hitchens, we'd agree with this thesis. We'd say that is definitely so. That science and religion just can't see eye to eye, and they have nothing in common. There is no discussion required. Now, I want to question that thesis, and that's what I'm going to do in the next two talks. But many scientists up to the 19th century were believers. Isaac Newton was a believer. Practicing Christians on both sides of the debate, there are many Christians who are amazing scientists. And that brings me to people like Dawkins, who say, oh, if you practice science in the week, Monday to Friday, then you can't go to synagogue on Saturday and in church on Sunday. It's hypocritical. I don't seem to agree with that. So Lindbergh, Numbers, and Brooke, ever since the 1970s, challenged the conflict thesis and said, let us look at the historical context of disputes between science and Christianity. So, in the 20th century, with the growth of other disciplines, in the 20th century, with the growth of other disciplines, interdisciplinarity found this conflict thesis or this warfare reading to be too simplistic. There was a variation in this long-standing relationship between science and religion, and now there's a new historiography. It focuses on multiplicity within religion and science, revealing greater depth in the relationship rather than a mere conflict thesis characterizing this relationship. Can all of you hear me? Okay. Now, many people don't know this, but it's amazing that Christianity positively sponsored the development of the early modern sciences and encouraged empirical study of the world. In 1517, Martin Luther's Reformation broke the stranglehold of the church, starting the Reformation. And the Reformation was a very tumultuous period, which ironically reasserted Christianity, the priesthood of all believers and the authority of the individual conscience, and opened the way to private doubt and secular thinking. I find this absolutely amazing, because there was a similar kind of movement in Islam by a man called Muhammad Wahhabi, who actually questioned what he said were too many innovations coming into Islam, and we need to return to the scripture and a literal interpretation of the scripture. And that led to the fundamentalism that we see today. So it went in a different direction, but we'll talk about that in my third lecture. So the Western intellectuals' critical faculty became more acute. A distinction was created between material process of reality and divinity. And now we're in the period of the Enlightenment. So this supported the growth of a critical scientific mentality. And I'm sure some of you have read this fascinating book by Richard Tanas called The Passion of the Western Mind. Absolutely amazing. And this was an impulse to the Renaissance. And I want to emphasize to you that right now, whatever I've said happened in the Christian world and not in the Islamic world. So the current debate is polarized and would give you the impression that this hostility between science and religion always existed. And never a day goes by when there's some article, even in the media or in specialized magazines or journals, the God disunion. There is a place for faith in science, insists Winston. And I want to say something about Winston just now, but I just want to show you some of the other headlines that you come across. Fundamental questions. America debates the place of Darwin and God in schools. And we're going to talk about intelligent design on Wednesday. Science versus religion. Time for a truce. God is bread. And this was religious belief can be viewed as an adaptation that was favored as the human brain evolved. And Lewis Wolpert was the one who actually wrote this. But over the weekend I read about him, he's run into trouble for plagiarism, so I'm not sure whether to believe it. And America is caught in a conflict between science and God. Can science and God ever get along? But I want to go back to Winston, because he interests me. This man is no pushover. This man is part of the Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London. He's now Lord Winston. He's a pioneer scientist in vitro fertilization. And he wrote this book, Robert Winston, Story of God. And in this book, if I can just quote, he says, there's a wrestling match between God and science. Now that we have science, it is said, we do not need God. As I hope to explain in this book, this dispute, and therefore this question, are largely vacuous. God and science are essentially two totally different ways of looking at the natural world, though each gives important insights into the nature of the other. Many people, including a considerable number of scientists, claim that a belief in God is harmful, citing in evidence the bitterness, damage, death and destruction that religion has caused throughout the ages. But this is rather like denigrating the pursuit of scientific investigation by reference to the amount of harm that has been done in developing terrible weapons and in damaging the Earth's natural environment. We must not confuse religion with God or technology with science. Religion stands in relationship to God as technology does in relation to science. Both the conduct of religion and the pursuit of technology are capable of leading humankind into evil, but both can promote great good. And I think here is an intelligent opinion, an intelligent view, and one that needs to be heeded seriously. And then on the other side, you hear somebody saying, "Dear religion, this week I safely dropped a man from space while you shot a child in the head for wanting to go to school." And that was in relation to the shooting of Malala Yousafzai by the Taliban. So, where do the problems lie? The creationists say God created the universe and everything in it. As a Muslim, I'm expected to believe that God knitted each one of us with his own hands, or he knitted Adam with his own hands. Okay. Now, whether that God is transcendental or immanent hasn't really been answered. The idea of an immanent God, I think, came with Spinoza. So, the alternative view is life came about by the process of evolution. But the difference between the two views is not so, I mean, they're not completely and utterly divided into two different camps. John Lennox was here from Oxford recently, and he says he accepts evolution and science is compatible with his religious belief. He's a Christian. So people make these accommodations in their minds. So Dawkins' idea that of eradicating religion completely and the world would be a happier place is questionable. Although I like Dawkins very much, I must tell you, I've read all his books. So it's come down, the current debates are hostile. It's come down simply to faith versus rationality. And the religious or the faithful say that scientists look down upon us, they're patronizing and they're offensive. Why? So at about this time, I'm sorry about that slide, I was very interested in this debate, and I sort of been talking to people about their religious views, and as a scientist, I also found great difficulty in some of the things that people believe in our day-to-day lives. And this is one of the articles I read in the Cape Times, but it was apparently published in the Natal Mercury and in other other newspapers. And it was called, it was entitled The Miracle of Biology. Or look around you and you'll see what the real miracles are. And it's about a 17-year-old young lady, Francesca Zacchi, who claimed that she saw the vision of Mother Mary in the sun. And so another woman, Amak Nassif, 37 years old, looked into the sun directly and damaged her eyesight. Now, there were letters from ophthalmologists in the newspapers asking, how can such a thing happen? How can somebody listen to a 17-year-old and then damage her eyesight? So, I've been receiving mail from people who say that a satellite circling the earth caught the name of Allah on one of the oceans, or that somebody saw the vision of Muhammad or Jesus in bread, in a tomato, or on the moon. Now, the question I asked in my article in the Cape Times was, do such claims strengthen belief? And how do we in the 21st century deal with such beliefs? Because they open people to ridicule. So my response was simply that the miracle is that the satellite that took the picture while in orbit around the globe, because it's a testimony to the ability of the human mind to produce such an invention, which is in the realm of science fiction, is actually the miracle here. Never mind seeing the name of God in the ocean. And then I quoted from science. And this is very important for me because I've been telling a lot of my fellow Muslims, read some science. So I wouldn't have to go to mosque on a Friday and listen to what I heard in the last 40 or 50 years with no change whatsoever. So many things are happening in the world. So many things to marvel at. So many achievements to marvel at. Why are we so static, and why aren't we moving? Why aren't we engaging with the scientific endeavor? Why should that threaten one's faith? So, I quoted from Doris Sowell, a Harvard-based biologist, who said that our brains process faces differently. So, if you have a stroke in the temporal lobe of your brain, you can get a condition called prosopagnosia, where you wouldn't be able to recognize faces. And the temporal lobe, funnily enough, in the normal state, in all, well, I hope we're all normal here, does not require all the features of a face to actually recognize it. That's what Doris Sau found, and she published this in Nature. So the lesson I said in that article is we need a deeper contemplation of our beliefs and religious ideas, rather than a dependence on rumor and anecdote to guide us in our daily lives. So, now, despite the problems, all these problems that I mentioned, I believe that the history of science and religion is actually intertwined. That if you talk about the history and development of science, you cannot ignore religion. It's entirely up to the individual to reject religion. But as a scientist, one can accept religion and make an accommodation for it. So, I want to talk a little bit about myself, if you don't mind. And this is not from my huge ego. I just want to actually tell you how this debate grew for me and how I actually dealt with it. I had an extremely religious upbringing, an extremely religious childhood in a conservative but very lovely Muslim home. But there was a prepackaged religion handed over to me, and I was told that this is the truth and the absolute truth, and if you live your life according to these principles, you'll go to heaven. And I think that's been the experience of a lot of people, not only Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus. So I lived in dead certainty. I knew my parents loved me. I knew that I was going to go to heaven if I was a good boy, and I prayed 5 times a day. I began to buy heart the Quran at about the age of 4 or 5, if I can remember, huge chunks of it, and my parents were very, very proud of it. And if I had any anxieties, my mother or my father would say, recite this particular verse from the Holy Quran, and your anxiety would go away. And that worked. It doesn't work now. So, the community itself was religious, ever more religious now than ever. I've been back there to this little village in KwaZulu-Natal called Greytown, and didn't recognize any of the friends I grew up with because their beards had sort of grown very long. And I can remember being a good debater in school, and was once discussing with the debate master as to what topics would be appropriate for a debate, and one of the things he mentioned was, is there God? And I went home quite innocently and mentioned that to my father, and he had an absolute fit. He said, there is no question about it, and it should not be debated. Another teacher, a very enthusiastic one, who actually came to school when I was in matric, one day raised some question about the sexual orientation of Jesus Christ. Now, you've got to know that Jesus Christ is very revered amongst Muslims. And I innocently again went home and mentioned it to my father, who called the congregation together in the mosque that evening and gave the teachers a tongue lashing, the Muslim teachers who were in the mosque. And I was in serious trouble in school the next day. And I also remember my father being very angry that I was reading a magazine that had a picture of the statue of David showing all the apparatus and everything, and he was absolutely annoyed, and he said, how can a man of God and a prophet of God be depicted like this? So those were some of my experiences. Now, an elder brother came to visit once, and I found him engrossed in this book. I must have been about grade 7 or grade 8, and he was reading Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. And every time he left the house, I grabbed the book and began to read it, and suddenly I thought to myself, wow, I've got the answer to life. All I have to do is think positively and believe in God. The only problem with this God is it wasn't my God, it wasn't Allah, he was Jesus Christ. That made me a little uncomfortable. And I used to be picked up early in the morning by one or two elders in the community to go to mosque, to the pre-dawn prayer. For some reason they picked me up and not my friends. And this one man who picked me up one day had lent me How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And in it, Carnegie mentions the golden rule from Matthew, do to others what you would have to do to you. What you would have to do to you. And so integrated into these books was the formula for successful living. And the prerequisite was believe in a creator. Now, on our drive back from the mosque, I said to this man, there can never be no God. And he got the shock of his life. I mean, his reaction shocked me. He looked at me, he said, "Why do you say that?" I said, "No, when Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale say that." He said, "Yeah, but why do you say that? Are you doubting the existence of God?" And I said, "No, not. I'm just telling you what I read." But the rest of the drive was pretty uncomfortable. He looked absolutely amazed and shocked. And not long after that, somebody who was a peer of my brother came back from overseas, a Muslim man, whom I'm still in contact with because he really stimulated my thinking. He came back and he said to me, "You know, there's no God." And I got another shock of my life. I said, "What do you mean there's no God?" He said, "I'm telling you, you know, there's no God. I mean, we've been fooled. And I cannot tell you the anxiety I suffered. I'm not going to tell you any more about my life in Greytown. But I just want to tell you that I was in agony. I was really worried. I was worried about him and his soul. I was worried about my parents getting to know about it, although he wasn't their son. And I was imagining all sorts of things and absolute fallout in the community." Now, about that time, I think I must have been matric, we're just off to university. I got hold of James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. And, you know, Joyce, poor Joyce, who was dressed up on a Sunday in Catholic Ireland and taken to church. And he described in this book how absolutely terrified he was. And I couldn't believe that there were other people in the world who could be so terrified, because I heard what Joyce heard in the church, I heard in the madrasa. And I was equally terrified that every time I had a bad thought or I committed a sin, I would have it in hell. So he said, "I listened to my fair share of hellfire sermons. In fact, hell seemed a more potent reality than God." And this is Karen Armstrong quoting him. But Karen Armstrong, in one of her books, I think, I don't have the list in front of me, I think it's The Search for God, where she says that we shouldn't throw out all our myths and rely too much on logic. There should be a fine balance between mythos and logos for us to develop and live a healthy mental existence. Now, Joyce went to a retreat, and there was, I think, a Father Arndale. The retreat was for a saint, Saint Xavier. And Father Arndale was telling them that if you sin, and he described it like this, ever to be in hell, never to be in heaven, ever to be eaten with flames, gnawed by vermin, goaded with burning, spikes, pains, conscience, darkness, and it goes on and on and on. The interesting thing about these passages is that the atheists who attack religion quote Joyce, and they say, this is a form of child abuse. This is why religion should totally and utterly be abandoned. Then another writer that I read was, of course, Carl Jung, who in his passionate quest to understand God and to resist sinful thoughts. Now, Jung was having a bad time, having bad thoughts, and he was wondering whether he's going to be punished and how he was going to be punished. This is from his autobiography, Memories, Dreams and Reflections. And then one day he was standing before a cathedral somewhere in Cologne, I think it was, and having some bad thoughts, and then it suddenly struck him that obviously God also desires me to show courage. If that is so, and I go through with it, then he would give me his grace and illumination. So he was looking at this cathedral and he imagined God hovering above it on his throne and then suddenly releasing a turd which hit the cathedral and smashed it to smithereens. Now, I don't know why the turd reached the church, because God was on his throne, but anyway, that was Jung's imagination. And then he waited for damnation, and it never came. Instead, he felt a sense of release. And it's very nicely described by a man called Colin Wilson in his Lord of the Underworld. But the conclusion that Jung came to was something that pleased me very much, that God does not want a mindless follower, but someone who had the courage to set his imagination free to experience the true grace of God, not to renounce his own views and convictions. A sense of relief for them and for me from tensions and anxiety that I had carried ever since my madrasa days. Madrasa is the Muslim school. And I realized that my experiences were not confined to the Muslim faith. So, looking back at my life, and looking back at how it panned out and how my childhood experiences influenced my life after that, what was compromised by all of this was the ability to develop the faculty of critical thought at a formative stage of one's young life. And what was taken away from young people was the right to question. And this is what Dawkins and company call the religious abuse of children. But most importantly for me, one's curiosity was dampened. And that's because we were not allowed to question. Now, I've been a teacher at UCT Medical School for years and years, and I've noticed the children that come from a particular culture, even probably sometimes considered to be rude to ask a question in the class. The teacher is someone who's to be respected, and asking a question seems cheeky and disrespectful. And I think it's this kind of culture which hasn't done our young people or anybody any good. Now, so the lessons I learned from people like Joyce and Hume were, and the questions that were raised in my mind, is that if scriptures are to be followed literally and religion handed to one by an external source, then what is the mind for? Why are we indulging in literal interpretations of texts? And so I embarked on a scientific career with ample opportunity to set myself on a path to explore other ideas on God and religion. And I felt freer. I have no problem with my parents. I think they gave me what they thought was best. But I did feel a sense of freedom with university, living in residence, meeting other students, and discussing these issues. So, at about this time, by the time when I was a postgraduate student at UCT, an astonishing book came about. I'm sure some of you here have read it, The Road Less Traveled by Scott and Beck. And in it he says some extremely interesting things. The road to spiritual growth lies in the death of our cherished notions. Reject the religion of your parents. This became a cult book for a while. Distrust what you believe and we're taught to believe. The path to holiness lies in questioning everything. I think this was music to my ears, and I wish it had come earlier. So, he says something strange here. Begin with the religion of science. A worldview of international character and of considerable complexity with a number of major tenets. Scientists, through their work, need to see the reality of God. So he actually spoke about religion as a science, which I don't agree with, and I thought that was interesting. But he did say somewhere in the book that when a scientist discovers something, when a scientist performs an experiment in the laboratory to answer a particular question, does she or he see the reality of God? And I was just very relieved to be able to read these books and be in an open environment. So, currently, as I said, the conflict is bad. It is science versus religion. And it gets very bad sometimes. All of us watch David Attenborough's programs, beautiful programs of nature. And Attenborough sometimes say, the people at the BBC, they doctor his documentaries and try and bring creationism into it. On the other side, scientists have been unhappy with Attenborough. He says that his God talk, for example, the use of the word design, this is how ridiculous this debate gets at times. You're using the word design, so you're implying that there's a designer who is a creator, and you should stop that. And that is absolutely ridiculous. You have to watch everything you say. And if you've read this remarkable book, which I read intermittently since 1988. I bought it in Hong Kong. And it's an encyclopedia, A Brief History of Time, by Stephen Hawking. We're going to talk more about it later. But Hawking said, if the day we actually find, if we are able to unite gravity with quantum theory, we'll know the mind of God. A lot of religious people jumped at it. They said, he's secretly a believer. So, and Einstein, when he heard about quantum theory and that the universe might be built on an uncertainty principle, he said God will not play dice. He refused to accept it. So again, everybody said, well, he must have been a very religious man. And so the scientists try to reject that idea, and the religious people keep saying, no, Hawking is a closet Christian, and Einstein was a closet Jew. So the debate between supposedly monolithic entities crystallized around Darwin and the theory of evolution. And today, if you look at this debate in any publication, it's actually evolution versus religion. So I think there's many aspects to science that's acceptable to most people besides evolution. So the history of science shows that the Royal Society in the 17th century valued both institutions. The logical inconsistency between the two was crucial for the emergence of modern science, as contradictions in each area were confronted. Now, this man, Edward Wilson, as I said to you, I have my prejudices. This man I find absolutely amazing. Just now I'll talk about his book, Consilience. Now in that book, Wilson must be one of the greatest living biologists. I think he has described every species of ant. In fact, he spent so many time with ants in the remotest parts of the world, that he says at an early age he became bent because he was looking over at his ants. He's now almost 90 years old. I did mention to the Vice-Chancellor, I think, once that we should invite Edward Wilson, but I heard that he doesn't travel anymore, and then last year I heard he was in Mozambique. Now, he says there's a growing consilience, a unity between the physical and biological sciences. So you can take physics and chemistry and biology and find this unity. And there's a duality between the material and the human sciences. So that's where the problem lies. The basic sciences not terribly interested in listening to what the sociologists and the people in the humanities have to say. So, an awareness of the relational complexity of the world and the contextual limitations of each field of inquiry. And this is how knowledge is growing. That we become too specialized in a particular field and we develop a world view from that. And that is why we're not making any headway. What we should be doing is talking to each other from disparate disciplines and to get a more coherent picture of what's going on in this universe. So, theologians are exploring the possibility of an interdisciplinary engagement between science and religion. And please, I'm not saying combine the two, because that's when you could have intelligent design and the other debate. But a man that I've been debating with in the Muslim community, Dr. Uwais Rafuddin, who wrote a regular column in the Muslim Views, said that perhaps scripture, with its ethical and moral principles, could guide scientists in their work. But we will talk about that just now. But we're now in an age where people can ask, can science show religion the way? Now, can you believe how far we've come in the last few hundred years? There was a time when the church had a stranglehold over people. You could not believe in God. And that is still going on largely in the Muslim world. If you read the press, how people are threatened when they express an individual view or they draw a cartoon, something like that, everybody is up in arms and says, hey, I'm going to get you. So in this 21st century, I think this is a wonderful question. Can science show religion the way? This article I read while on a visit to London in the 90s, does it have to be science versus religion? We should explore every path in the search for faith, says the physicist Dana Zohar. And in this article she quotes Albert Einstein. She says, science, a new way of thinking, cannot replace religion, but a religion based on dogma that clashes with new thinking will clash with the modern mind. And she quotes René Descartes, the 17th century philosopher, the credo of modern science rejects all received opinions. Let me know only what I can know with the power of my own mind. She quotes Nietzsche, there's no absolute truth. And Rion Schulz says, consider that in 1500 it was impossible not to believe in God. Today, if you read Charles Taylor, we're living in a secular age. But it's not true for the entire group. Okay? And my exploration continues, and recently I came across John Holt's book, Why Does the World Exist? Why is there something rather than nothing? This is the 21st century debate. This is what scientists, the whole debate is revolving around this. And Holt describes himself as a callow, rebellious youth who one day read Heidegger's Introduction to Metaphysics. And he said that this question, why is there something rather than nothing, is a profound question for a metaphysician, or a question so simple it would occur to a curious child. But his curiosity was stifled as a child. He was told, the world and I exist because an eternal God created it out of nothing. Who created God? At least he was allowed to ask that. And he was told that God was omnipotent enough to have created himself. So, is it all war? Okay, and let's just look at this. Let's just look a bit at what's happening today. In the 1930s, can I have a sip of water? Am I allowed to?
Yes.
Hey, my heart's right. In the 1930s, Edwin Hubble reports that the universe is expanding, and that it started from a singularity, a Big Bang model. And Hawkins talks about it in his book. Now, did it start from nothing? Or was it a relic of a previously collapsed universe? So Hawkins, Holt, and people who are physicists are asking that question, right? Now, it's an important question, because if you say it started with the Big Bang, then there must have been a point in the history of this universe where the laws of physics didn't apply, and scientists don't like that. Now, it seems impossible that you could get something from nothing, but once there was nothing and now there is a universe, is evident proof that you can. And this is by Bill Bryson in The Short History of Nearly Everything. So, religious people are interested in the anthropic principle, the physical constants, like the ratio between in weight between a proton and an electron. And what they're saying is there was so much fine-tuning at the beginning of the formation of this universe that there must have been a purpose behind it. And eventually the purpose was that one day you and I will be here in this lecture hall and you'd be listening to me and wondering, why am I spending my evening with this guy? Now, there's a whole lot of things. I mean, if Hawking talks about these things, he says somewhere, I've got it here, he says, at the Big Bang itself, the universe is thought to have zero size, and so to have been infinitely hot. But as the universe expanded, the temperature of the radiation decreased. 1 second after the Big Bang, it would have fallen to about 10,000 million degrees. This is about 1,000 times the temperature of the center of the sun. But temperatures as high as this are reached in hydrogen bomb explosions. At this time, the universe would have contained mostly photons, electrons, and neutrinos, right? Together with some protons and neutrons. Now, that happened, and then he goes on to say on the next page, about 100 seconds after the Big Bang, the temperature would have fallen to 1,000 million degrees. So from 10,000 million degrees to 1,000 million degrees, about 100 seconds after the Big Bang, and then within only a few hours of the Big Bang, the production of helium and other elements would have stopped, and after that, for the next million years or so, the universe would have just continued expanding without anything much happening. Eventually, once the temperature had dropped to a few thousand degrees and electrons and nuclei no longer had enough energy to overcome the electromagnetic attraction between them, they would have started combining to form atoms. Now, what he's saying here is, it almost seemed as if everything was absolutely precise. Right? The physical constants were precise, the temperature changes were precise, things happened at the exact time, the inflation happened at the appropriate time. It's almost as if someone out there is fine-tuning this thing so that eventually there will be conscious beings on this planet. And that's the entropic principle. Now, Hawking's response to that is the multiverse, the quantum theory. Hawking says, perhaps there are many universes instead of just ours. And each one is configured completely differently. The laws of science that apply here probably wouldn't apply there. And amongst these many, 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 many universes, there's this, just this one that happened to be just right for you and me. So the point is, these are very close to religious questions. Okay. Now I just want to, for a moment, just bear with me. I want to actually consider this entropic principle. There are two types, according to Hawking, and he talks about them here. The weak one: in a large universe, infinite in space or time, the conditions necessary for the development of intelligent life will be met only in certain regions that are limited in space and time, a locality in which conditions necessary for our existence are satisfied. So, in this Milky Way galaxy, at one far corner, there's an area or locality in which things are just absolutely right for us to come into being. The strong version of the principle is that there are many different universes or many different regions of a single universe, each with its own initial conditions and perhaps its own set of laws of science. Conditions in most would not be right for intelligent life. Only in our kind of universe can intelligent life develop and ask, why is the universe the way we see it? Because if it had been different, we would not be here. So those are the two versions. Very exciting stuff. So I always say to my students, ask the big questions. What I'm encouraging young people to do is to place themselves in a particular context. It's not as if you were born in 1988 and all you know about what happened between 1988 and now is all that matters. And so you have to concentrate on Kim Kardashian or Wayne Rooney and tell people how much Wayne Rooney earns. What's your context? What are the big questions? Most of them are unanswerable. But every age has considered them. How did the universe begin? How will it end? What is life and how did it come about? What is mind and consciousness? A big question in this 21st century. What is the meaning of life? And when we discuss more about Dawkins, we will come back to this thing, this business of meaning. Matters of the afterlife. In some religions, there's more focus on the afterlife than on this life. And I find that hugely problematic. Does God exist? Do I have free will? That's a bad one because it's causing a lot of conflict. What is time? Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Whatever you say, these are religious and scientific questions. Our very own David Benatar has edited a book which I've referenced. There's reference 9. You'll see the list tomorrow, in which he says these are both religious and scientific questions. Therefore, scientists and religious people grapple with the big questions. Now, Hawking has an alternative to the Big Bang model, which he calls the no-boundary model, that the universe is infinite in time, is completely self-contained without beginning or end. So it always existed. It's a different model. It's more difficult to grasp. God is not required in this model. It's a self-sustaining universe, a cause of itself. Very similar to the ideas that Spinoza expressed when he lived in Amsterdam. Yet Hawking doubts that, you know, this is the strange thing. Hawking doubts, and this is what Hall says, he doubts that his set of equations yield a complete resolution to the mystery of existence. What is it, he asks, that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Why does the universe go through all the damn bother of existing? That's the question. And it's a mystery. And this point about the mystery, the atheists like Dawkins and Dennett and Hitchens hate. Because Dawkins says, I'm tired of being posed with the question of mystery. Time and again, my theologian friends return to the point that there is something rather than nothing. And I know there is something rather than nothing. But Hitchens was once asked, that if you don't accept that there's a God, how can you explain why the world exists at all? It defies logic and reason that the world came out of absolutely nothing. And this one woman apparently asked him on a BBC program, what came before the Big Bang? And he said, Madam, I'd love to know what came before the Big Bang. Now, Dawkins is hopeful that science will eventually answer all these questions. He's a real optimist, Dawkins, right? Whereas people like Einstein said, you solve one problem and there's another mystery behind it. Okay? And the age-old biologist, Lewis Thomas, who wrote The Lives of a Cell, The Medusa and the Snail, Late Night Thoughts in the 70s and 80s, said, nature will not yield her secrets easily. And I think we all know that. I've been standing at a laboratory bench for 30 years, and every time I think I've made an amazing breakthrough, somebody comes along the next day and says, it's absolute rubbish. Yeah. But here I'm just quoting from John Barrow, who's a professor of mathematical sciences in Cambridge and who won the Templeton Award in 2006. And he says, many of the deepest and most engaging questions that we grapple with about the nature of the universe have their origins in our purely religious quest for meaning. The concept of a lawful universe with order that can be understood and relied upon emerged largely out of religious beliefs about the nature of God. To ask the big scientific questions is a quasi-religious enterprise that has transformed the simple-minded, life-averse, meaningless universe of the skeptical philosophers. This is John D. Barrow. So, Sohar, in her article in the Sunday Times, touched me very deeply because some of these thoughts had come to me when I was going through those agonizing years. And she says, the thing about religious thinking, she refers to Christianity, but I think it's religious thinking generally, is that the thinking is top down. It starts with a unified vision of truth and imposes this on the world as a ready-made set of beliefs, the foundation of which is revelation and authority. So here it is, you take it, you don't question it, and you accept it in its entirety. Right? Now, Christianity is an ongoing attempt to impose unity on the diversity of experience. Everything knowable is already known, and the truth is a closed system. Now, I've had this experience where, when I'm sitting with people, they talk about so Muhammad's ascension to the heavens on something that was half man, half human. Now, it raises a lot of questions. It raises questions about, first, is it genetically possible to have such a creature? Secondly, what about temperature differences? I mean, lack of oxygen, etc., etc. Now, I say to people, as a scientist, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the virgin birth. I have a problem with many, many aspects of religion. But if I belonged to any one of those religions, and if I accepted this, how will I actually accommodate it? I mean, then those questions come to us from time to time. So, science too tries to give the world a coherent picture of the world and our place in it, but it does so by observation and experiment. So that's different from revelation and authority. The scientific enterprise is bottom-up. It is an ongoing attempt to unite the diversity of experience through theory. There is always something beyond theory that keeps the scientific enterprise open-ended. Am I beyond my time here? Because the universe is 13.4 billion years old, so this is that. So, ladies and gentlemen, now you know why a medical biochemist, somebody who spent his life dabbling with mucus from every part of the body, is so, so interested in this debate. I love it. And I love it. I said this in the Cape Times once, that the intersection of science and religion is a topic that is as stimulating today as it was since the early Islamic period, when the debate was about reason and revelation, and later during the Enlightenment, when a clear distinction was made between science and religion. The progress of this debate is partly my own story. It goes to the core of our values and development. big questions asked by scientists and religious people. The perspective permeates into every aspect of their lives. The question of whether there exists a supernatural creator, a God, is one of the most important that we have to answer. And this is Richard Dawkins. I think that it is a scientific question, he says. No, says Francis Collins, the head of the NIH, the head of the Human Genome Project, science does not have the tools to answer whether God exists or not. And then, of course, there is the question of evolution. Now, there are people on both sides of the divide who deal with this all the time. One of them is Harold Kushner. Now, Harold Kushner was a rabbi, well, probably is a rabbi, and I'll be finishing soon, don't be too bored. His first son was born with progeria, which you know is accelerated aging. By the time the child is six, his body is about 50 or 60 years old. We had a case in South Africa called Francie, I think, a long time ago. Now Francis, Harold Kushner says he had a fight with God. He says, I've been so good in my life. I've been observant. I've helped so many people. I've counseled so many people. And you give me a son that has progeria. So he eventually came to realize that the universe was built on and governed by the laws of nature. Okay, for example, gravity. Heavy objects fall. That's the law of nature. They fall towards the earth. That's why your house is still there in the morning when you get up. And it's not floating in the heavens. So, as you're sitting here, you're not thinking about your next heartbeat. Hey, you know what, I must make sure that my heart beats, otherwise I'll be dead. Or you're not thinking of the meal you're digesting that you just had, or the mutations that are taking place in your cells as you're sitting here. Some of them beneficial, some of them neutral, some of them harmful. And mutations are random. So, these laws are precise and reliable, and they do not change. We are miracles not because we defy these laws of nature, but precisely because of them. So that was his view. Now, the other one was Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was an amazing scientist. The late Stephen Jay Gould, Harvard biologist, who did any amount of work, or most of the work probably, he's a paleontologist, on the Cambrian period, and describing the burst of multicellularity during that period. And Stephen Jay Gould says that both science, he says the cancer skirmish, so he's actually referring to the intelligent design debate. The cancer skirmish marks the latest episode of a long struggle by religious fundamentalists and their allies to restrict or eliminate the teaching of evolution in public schools. A misguided effort that our courts have quashed at each stage and that saddens both scientists and most theologians. No scientific theory, including evolution, can pose any threat to religion, for these two great tools of human understanding operate in complementary, not contrary fashion in their totally separate realms. Science is an inquiry about the factual state of the natural world. Religion as a search for spiritual meaning and ethical values, and he called that theory the theory of noma, the non-overlapping magisteria. Science tells us how it came about, religion gives meaning to our existence. Okay. And unfortunately, Dawkins and the others hated Gould's noma. Dawkins accused him, he says, Gould's separate compartments was purely a political ploy to win middle-of-the-road religious people to the science camp, but it's an empty idea. So there's a book out called Gould versus Dawkins, and this is one of the areas of contention. There are others. Francis Collins, on the other hand, the believing scientist, accused Gould of creating an artificial wall between two worldviews that doesn't exist in my life, he says. God's creative power brought it all into being in the first place. So when I study the natural world, I see the majesty, the elegance, the intricacy of God's creation. Dawkins says living things are made by gradual, incremental steps from simple beginnings to complexity, elegance and adaptive perfection. Colin says, that is not incompatible with God having designed it. Okay? And of course, back to my favorite. This is the book, Consilience. The first line says, I have always wanted unified learning. And Edwin O. Wilson wrote this book, Consilience, and in it he says, imagine 10,000 years ago, early farming communities and their reliance on supernatural forces for successful harvests. Could the Holy Writ be just the first literate attempt to explain the universe and make ourselves significant within it? We, whose deepest drives of the spirit to make ourselves more than animated dust. Science is a continuation of the same effort on better tested ground to attain the same end. Science is then religion, liberated and writ large. Lovely words. So, I just want to go back to Collins. Collins is a physician, a geneticist, and he was the leader of the Human Genome Project. He was an advisor, I think, to one of the presidents, either Clinton or still advisors Obama on scientific issues. He was the director of the National Institute of Health. So he's no small fry. And he's being mocked at for being a believer. Okay? And he advocates the perspective that belief in Christianity can be reconciled with acceptance of evolution and science. So, in the language of God, right, he says, we must not, then as Christians, assume an attitude of antagonism toward the truths of reason, or the truths of philosophy, or the truths of science, or the truths of history, or the truths of criticism. And then he goes on to say, as children of the light, we must be careful to keep ourselves open to every ray of light. Let us cultivate an attitude of courage as over against the investigation of the day. None should be more zealous in them than we. None could be more quick to discern truth in every field, more hospitable to receive it, more loyal to follow it, whithersoever it leads. So he says he's extremely happy about scientific findings. He finds no incompatibility between science and his religion. John Lennox said that here when he was here. And Collins then quotes St. Augustine. He says, in matters that are so obscure and far beyond our vision, we find in Holy Scripture passages which can be interpreted in very different ways without prejudice to the faith we have received. In such cases, we should not rush in headlong and so firmly take our stand on one side that if further progress in the search for truth justly undermines this position, we too fall with it. Okay, so if God is God, who is meant to be the author of this universe, honored or dishonored by those who demand that his people ignore rigorous scientific conclusions about his creation? Can faith in a loving God be built on a foundation of lies about nature? And there are three important considerations here: the earth-centered to the heliocentric universe, the origins of the universe, and of course the theory of evolution. And after all, evolution controversy reaches into the very heart of both faith and science. I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason and intellect has intended us to forgo their use. And what he's saying is that when somebody discovers a fossil in Africa, which suddenly then fits into the theory of, say, the Australopithecines, which one branch of which eventually became Homo sapiens or Homo habilis and then Homo sapiens. He says, how can we say it's not true? Because it's not in the Bible or the Quran. And Wilson puts it nicely. He says, we've got two very powerful streams of thought, most powerful forces in the universe today, religion and science, which should set aside the differences and work together to save the planet. So those are the issues I've been actually dealing with. Some of them are my personal prejudice. I think I'm going to stop now. When my son comes onto the screen, I know I have to stop. But I'd like some discussion, but I know I've gone over the time. I promise you for the next two talks, I'll stick to the time. I was just judging myself. Thank you. You're welcome to criticize me. Yes.
The concept of order as a religious concept, is proof of that there must be a greater being to have created the universe in such an ordered manner as the Big Bang. And what about, you know, what is before, you kept on saying, but the scientists apparently believe that time started with the Big Bang.
Right.
So how do you answer that?
Well, some scientists believe in the Big Bang model. Sir?
Question?
We
can't hear.
The question is, partly the question is what came before the Big Bang, and if time began at the Big Bang, and God has created a very, very ordered universe, and what do scientists have to say about that? Now, there's three or four separate questions there. I want to first deal with this question of the Big Bang. It's one model for the existence of this universe. I mentioned another one where Hawkins feels that there was no beginning, that the universe just was infinite, it existed all the time. So we don't know which one is right, but we have to deal with both of them and listen to what the scientists have to say. But this business of order, I just want to actually deal with. If you look around you, there's order. Each one of us expresses order. What we don't realize, and again, Hawkins says this in his book, what we don't realize is because we only have a view of ourselves and our lives, and our ordered lives, we don't appreciate the fact that there are more disordered states than ordered in the universe. Now, if you take a jigsaw puzzle, he says, there's only one way to put it together to get the picture, then it's ordered. But there's any number of ways you can actually place it in a disordered way. So there's more disorder than order, but we misled to believe that there's more order because our lives are ordered. But now that comes to, and I'm glad you asked the question, sir, because this comes to one of the basic laws of science, and that there is an increasing disorder in this universe. It's called the law of entropy, right? Now, the law of entropy works like this, and I'm going to explain it very simply because my mind works very, very simply. I come into this room and I see a lot of disorder. So I work very hard to make everything ordered. I place the books right, as neatly as I possibly can. I make sure that all of you are sitting, and all of you are listening, and you're not dancing on the table, and some people are not cartwheeling down those little passages. Now, I have worked, I have used energy which I got from my food, which was converted from one form to the other. And in the process of doing that work, I have actually given off heat, which has increased the disorder of the universe. So, you are ordered at the expense of the disorder of the universe. It's the second law of thermodynamics, right? And the world is moving towards disorder, and eventually it will reach a maximum state of disorder, which is a state of equilibrium, and it will be dead. This is the scientific view. I can't answer the religious view to that question because I don't know anything about it. Is there anything else? Yes?
Could I just ask you quickly? You said earlier on that you had a relationship with your mum and that she gave you texts to repeat to eliminate anxiety.
Yeah.
And then you said it worked for you, but it doesn't work anymore.
Well, I believed it. I think I believed it. I was so comfortable in being raised in such a sheltered environment. And I actually believed that if I did that, it's going to happen. And it happened. And the terrible thing that happened to me is that I had to go out into the world. to make a living and find my own path. And that's when I started exploring other ideas. So those things eventually didn't have that sense of priority.
Do you no longer have anything like that?
I was hoping nobody asks me that question.
Okay.
I would like to ask you, why is evolution regarded as an alternative to creation by God, as it could well be a method he uses to evolve his creation?
Oh, wonderful. That there are many creationists who would accept that view. But there are many religious people who hate that view, who say that the Quran says, or the Bible says, that we were actually made by God, put us together with clay or whatever they talk about, depending on the scripture. But recently there was a book called Islam and Biological Evolution. And for my sins, I was asked to review it. And the author was absolutely furious with me. Because in that book he said, he accepts evolution up to a point, but it ends at animals. We are a special creation. Adam was littered with God. God littered him with his own hands. And I thought I was very, very gracious when I reviewed the book. But by saying, it doesn't compare very well with the scientific view, in which we are told that evolution is a mindless, purposeless process with no intentional aim in mind. And that from the very time the first cell appeared, there was no specific path which went straight up to human beings of consciousness. Right? That's what evolution is about. And he was particularly angry with me for reviewing it in that way. You know, that was my prerogative. I do hide from him when I see
him. This is rather preposterous on my part, with my very limited mind and senility undoubted in 87. But one point that, and please, I now firstly congratulate you on the excellent case you presented for both sides, in my opinion. If you'd only presented the one side, I would have left there firmly believing in that. Fortunately, you were kind enough to provide both sides with the religious leaders and the scientists. But one point that I, in my opinion, I mean, I leave here absolutely none the wiser. But frankly, I don't know what the correct situation. There are so many possible scenarios.
Yes.
And to me, the biggest limitation is the weakness of Homo, the mind of Homo sapiens. But the question then arises, aren't we, I say we, the scientists and the religious leaders, should they be trying in their stupidity to analyze this thing, you know, sufficiently and accurately? It may be that with evolution being what it is, God knows why it should be such a slow process. But it could be that, like everything else in Homo sapiens, that the mind is going to develop in 100 years, 1,000 years, or 10,000 years, whatever, to a point where it, for example, understands this thing of ex nihili, creating something out of nothing, including God.
Yeah.
It all seems to be a little premature.
I sometimes in despair. Maybe we call him again the blossom, who says our brains are designed in a manner not to understand. And I find solace in that, because no matter which way you look at it, you grapple with these ideas all the time. People like doctors say, science will eventually give you all answers. When's that going to happen in 90 million years? You don't know. The debate is open-ended. That's what I like about it. My problem is that I can't go and talk about this to anybody and everyone. Some people are offended by the very mention of the word evolution. Absolutely offended. And I've tried this. I've written articles on it during Darwin's anniversary in the local newspaper, was banned in the Muslim press. And there was a reaction to it. So, there's no absolute answer, but that's not the reason why we shouldn't ask the big questions. Because then slowly and gradually there's little and little more understanding. It's a pity that we live for only 3 or 10 years. So we live